All right, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 231. No, it's not 231, it's Bio 241. And it is Thursday the 28th, and you have to come to order because I know you guys are having fun. I don't want to break that up, but we got to continue with talking about some information right here. Okay, I don't have any announcements, I don't believe. Oh, no, I do have an announcement. There has been a room change for SI. It is now in business. That's the building, 319, right? So BUS 319, and it is today, right? Got one today at 120. So there you go, a little bit of a room change. I don't know where it was before, maybe humanities? Too small? Okay, great. All right, so we were talking about this particular molecule right here last time before we had to quit. What the heck is that thing? Phospholipid. I don't know why almost everybody gets it wrong on the first test. Okay, so make sure you can recognize phospholipids and know something about them. So I just want to make sure that I kind of grab your attention right away. On the screen, okay, let's just review a little bit from last time. We said that there are four main kinds of biological molecules, important biological molecules. What are the four main kinds? Carbohydrates, lipids, proteins, and nucleic acids, right. Furthermore, as introduction, we started to talk about organic compounds versus inorganic compounds. So the ones that I have up over here, that big long hydrocarbon chain, is that organic or inorganic? It's organic because why? It's got carbon and hydrogens that are covalently bound to each other. That's the definition of an organic compound. And when you have any kind of large molecule like we have right here in hexane, look what it can do. It can form, yeah, cyclic structures, ring structures. That's a pretty stable form for a lot of these molecules. Although hexane is not important biologically, it is an organic compound. We have some biological compounds that are organic, right, that are really long. And these right here. Right, these are monosaccharides, and because they're long stringy molecules, what can they do? They can form ring structures as well. Okay, so I want you to use kind of that concept of ring structures for our discussion of this phospholipid. Okay, so make sure you can recognize this molecule and understand that it has two main domains. It has two main regions. What are the two regions that make this a magic molecule? There's a polar region and a nonpolar region, or there's a hydrophilic and a hydrophobic region. So this region right here is the hydrophobic region, and this is the hydrophilic region. So you should know why this is the hydrophobic region. Why is that the hydrophobic region? What's in this region right here? Big, long hydrocarbon chains from fatty acids. Right, fatty acid chains, and so that makes this region hydrophobic. It doesn't want to mix with water. And this one here is hydrophilic. Why do you know that that's a hydrophilic region? Because it has phosphate. What else does it have in there? Okay, you got to go back and take a look. All right, yeah, it's got some oxygens in there, but also this nitrogen. So it's got phosphate, nitrogen, oxygen. That makes it a very hydrophilic region in the molecule, so that if we get a salad dressing bottle that we have right here that's been in the refrigerator for a long time and drop that one molecule in there, and this is where we left off last time, where does it end up? Over here? And I tell you what's going to be on the top? Oil. And on the bottom is going to be water. Two different solvent systems. And remember, that just happens automatically, like you're all aware. Right? Where does that molecule go? Does it go up here, the top, or the bottom? Both. So you're kidding me. It goes like right there? And you got to tell me? Well, yeah, you're not kidding me. Why is that? Because the hydrophilic part is going to go in the water, and the hydrophobic part is going to stick up in the oil, because that's the nature of that molecule. And there's nothing special you have to do to put it exactly there. And it's going to go nowhere else except exactly there. All right, so that if instead of putting one molecule, we put hundreds of molecules, where are all those hundreds of molecules going to go? Same place, right? Right here. And so it's going to form a special boundary, just like this, all right, in the meniscus between the oil and the water. And that's pretty magical, I think, that that happens, all right? And this is beginning to resemble or remind me of some structure, an organelle, that helps make up a cell, okay? So this kind of reminds me now of a membrane that's actually separating two different parts of this bottle from each other, right? And so membranes do have this ability to self-assemble because of the nature of that phospholipid molecule, all right? So please be aware of what atoms produce polar kinds of covalent bonds that allow it to dissolve in water, like what? Oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, right? Be familiar with those things. Furthermore, if we have a bottle right here that only has water in it, right? We take the oil out, and now we put phospholipid in there. What's going to happen to that phospholipid? Right? It doesn't really know where to go. But if we put hundreds of these molecules in there, what's going to happen? It's going to form even another amazing kind of structure. All right? So what's going to be in the water? Is it going to be the tails, the hydrophobic tails? No. All right, it's going to be, oh, I kept the pen open too long. All right, the hydrophilic head groups, all right, are going to associate with the water molecule, and where are all these hydrophobic tails going to go? They're going to poke to the inside. All right, so now we've got a membrane forming this nice cyclic structure, which is really stable, because now all this hydrophobic area is inside. We call this a micelle, and the hydrophilic is sticking out into the water. Now, what does that kind of remind me of? We have a membrane completely separating the water environment from this internal environment right here. That kind of reminds me of a cell, right? So membranes just have this ability to form spontaneously and to make little pockets that are kind of like the precursors for cells. Because of what? Because of the different nature of the hydrophilic and hydrophobic regions on the phospholipid molecule. So that's why it's so important for you to know about. So here we have my cell, and you can see how water forms a hydration cell around this phospholipid. And a couple days ago we talked about chemical bonds, right? What are the four kinds of chemical bonds or associations or attractions between different molecules or atoms? Covalent. What is covalent in terms of strength? Yeah, it's strong and it's sharing. Then you got ionic, a little bit weaker, and what's that? Transfer of electrons. Then you have hydrogen bonds, which are even weaker. And then what's the fourth class? And how strong is that? Really, really weak. All right, so when you make a membrane like this out of phospholipids, what kind of association is holding the membrane together right here? These little tails right here. If I was going to give you a choice of covalent ionic hydrogen bonds or van der Waals forces, what kind of bonds are holding those hydrophobic tails together? It's a little bit more of a critical thinking kind of question. Okay. Well, covalent for sure is holding the carbon chain together, but what I'm specifically interested in is what is holding these two phospholipids together right in this region here between molecules. Okay, between the molecules right here. Okay, hydrogen bonds are the result of what? Polar compounds, polar associations, and van der Waals forces are due to when hydrophobic regions associate with each other. So what kind of regions are right here? Hydrophobic? Yeah, so what are holding these molecules together? Van der Waals forces. And what are they like? Very weak. So what can you tell me about a membrane? It's very fluid. It's held together, all right, with very weak kinds of forces if we're just thinking about a simple phospholipid layer or what we see in biology, a phospholipid bilayer. All right, but nonetheless, it works, but membranes are very fluid because of that. Okay. So this structure right here that's formed by all of these phospholipid molecules in a water solvent is what we call a micelle. And it should remind you of a cell. Okay. And And I'm going to talk about surfactants a little bit later on in the class. All right, other kinds of lipids besides fatty acids, triglycerides, and phospholipids. And kind of remember that a phospholipid is just kind of a special case of a triglyceride, right? It only has that one phosphate group and amino group in the last position, the third position, instead of a fatty acid that makes it a phospholipid. And if you don't ever want to be concerned or confused about a phospholipid, you might want to draw this out from memory maybe a couple times, all right, so that you can recognize it on a test. Okay, other kinds of lipid compounds are steroids, and steroids are hydrophobic compounds. We don't see nitrogen, okay, much in the way of oxygen on these compounds, so they are not water soluble. These are important signaling molecules in most cases. Hormones are made from cholesterol. Here is the basic look of cholesterol, and when you look at this, you should see something that looks like a staircase. A lot of ring structures right here. All right, so cortisol can be made from cholesterol, testosterone can be made from cholesterol, and estrogens. In particular, the example right here is estradiol. Now, I'm not going to ask you to know the difference in chemistry between testosterone and estradiol, but whenever you see like this staircase step right here, you should say steroid or sterol of some kind. All right, and you should know that it is what? Hydrophobic. Okay, it's a hydrophobic compound. All right. Cholesterol, you probably know, is harmful if it's in high concentrations inside your body because it produces cardiovascular disease. But of course, you need some in your body to make what? These different hormones that regulate processes in your body. All right, so you need just the right level. All right, so I'm going to show you that one. Another kind of lipid is if we take a fatty acid, which is a long hydrocarbon chain. Here's a carboxyl group on a fatty acid, and if one bend is put in it right here to make a hairpin turn, right, they can be converted into prostaglandin. And a prostaglandin is another kind of signaling molecule that can be used as a hormone or a control signal in different parts of the body, and they're just manufactured from fatty acids, right? So can you see this is just a fatty acid that's been bent in half? And sometimes these are involved in inflammatory response. We'll talk about various reasons why we have prostaglandins in our body during the class, but you should at least know that they are a lipid compound, right? So they're a lipid compound because they come from a fatty acid. And what can you tell me about this COOH right here? That's a carboxyl group, and what can you tell me about a carboxyl group? Is it going to make something acidic or basic or maintain something neutral? Okay. The COOH is a carboxylic acid group. All right. So this hydrogen can jump off and go into water. And when it does, it changes the pH of the water solution. Right. So if fatty acids are being produced and this hydrogen ion goes into solution, the concentration of hydrogen ion increases. What can you tell me about acidity of that solution? This is a review from last time. Okay, don't think pH, think acidity. The acidity goes up. Now what about the pH? It goes down, it goes the opposite way. Okay, all right, so don't be tricked by that one. Okay, so this takes us to our third compound, biological compound, and these are proteins. All right, the basic building block of a protein are amino acids, right? And just like you could tell me the basic building blocks of a polysaccharide. What's the basic building block of a polysaccharide? Monosaccharide. What's the basic building block of a triglyceride? Glycerol and three fatty acids, right? Your body puts them together, takes them apart with the same kinds of reactions, right? So, yeah, either dehydration synthesis when it's putting together or hydrolysis when these molecules are taken apart. All right, so here is what a generic form of a fatty acid looks like. Amino acid, right? Because, yeah, this carboxyl group means that it is acidic. It's an acid because it can donate that proton to solution. It also has an amino group right here, hence the term amino acid, right? So amino is one of the things that you had to be aware of. Now, this molecule, is this an organic molecule or inorganic? Okay, what's the first criteria? Got to have a carbon. Got a carbon in there? Yeah, good. Carbon. What about a carbon bound to a proton? Yeah, right here. Right. So here's a nice, or this is the definition for an organic compound. This is the generic form. There are 20 important, there are about 20 important. There's a couple other minor ones here and there, and there are some that really aren't considered amino acids because they don't make proteins, but they're used in your body. But nonetheless, this is a general form for an amino acid. It's got to have a carboxyl group. It's got to have an amino group. There's always a hydrogen or a proton right here. And there is a variable group on this central carbon. All right, this variable group can have different kinds of structures. For instance, it can have a very hydrophobic compound associated with them, right? So this is just a hydrocarbon. Here's an, as in valine, here's another hydrocarbon right here, tyrosine. And so these are nonpolar, right? Even though there's a 1H, there's an O right here, that's only one compound. So this is mostly a nonpolar group right here. So these will like to associate with each other. Other amino acids like arginine, cysteine, and we got aspartic acid, you can see that, for instance, in arginine, there's a lot of amino groups, so that means that this is a highly polar region in the molecule. Wants to be associated with the cytoplasm because it's water. The cysteine has a sulfur group. And remember, if there are neighboring cysteine amino acids in a protein, they can form a disulfide bridge and form a covalent bond that gives a tremendous amount of structure to that particular protein, right? And we said that that actually forms curls in hair. And you can't really take curls out of your hair without some pretty harsh chemical treatments because of these disulfide bridges that are produced. And then here is a carboxyl group that we see in aspartic acid. So different amino acids, right, have a commonality associated with them because they all have this amino group, carboxyl group, central carbon, but they're all different because they can have different R groups or functional groups in this position on the amino acid. All right, so they can be used for different things. Right, so when you change the structure of an amino acid, you're going to change what its function is going to be. Okay, so these, for instance, a cysteine is a very stabilizing kind of amino acid to have in a protein someplace, right? So this R just represents what? Variability at that one position in this amino acid. All right, so we said amino acids are a building block of protein. How are you going to make a protein? What do you need? Various amino acids. And you're going to put them together to make a protein. And what kind of reaction are you going to use to make a protein from amino acids? Dehydration synthesis reaction, right? So water is going to be pulled out. So let's see if I got something on the next slide. Maybe you guys do. See this already? Ah, good. Okay. So here we have amino acid number one, amino acid number two, amino acid number three, and these can all be different amino acids. So think of, and it's put together to make this protein right here. It's a really small protein. It only has four amino acids. Okay. But think of each of these amino acids as being a letter in a word, okay? And in order for a word to have meaning, it has to have the correct, what does it have to have the correct? In order for a four-letter word, I didn't notice that till right now. Four-letter word, in order to have the proper meaning, what can you tell me about the letters in that word? Can they have any order? No, it's got to have the right sequence. Right, and proteins have to have the correct sequence of amino acids to perform the correct function. Just like spelling a word has to be spelled right to have the right meaning. Okay, so they're put together by pulling out an H2O between the carboxyl group and amino group right here, and it's going to form this very strong bond, right? That's a nice covalent bond when water is pulled out. This is what we call a peptide bond. Peptide bonds are actually very strong. If we're going to rank covalent bonds in terms of their strength, that's a pretty strong kind of covalent bond. Peptide bonds are difficult to break. And in order for you to digest proteins that are put together by these peptide bonds, you need a special, super harsh environment to get things started. Where in your body is like the, is a very harsh environment? Well, almost nothing can live in the stomach, because the pH is somewhere between 1 and 0. And that environment is necessary for you to start that digestion process of peptide bonds, because they're very, very, very stable. But nonetheless, if you go from a protein back to these amino acids, what kind of reaction is necessary? A hydrolysis reaction, right? And that extreme pH is necessary to break this very stable peptide bond. Okay. All right, so if we have a protein that's less than 100 amino acids long, we call that a polypeptide. If it's greater, sometimes we call that a protein. I kind of don't adhere to that definition very much in the class, so please don't be confused. All right, sometimes it's really hard to tell what the difference is. Okay. All right, so protein structure is really important, because the structure of a protein is going to determine what? Its function. It's going to determine its function. So we want to be really aware of the structure of proteins. The primary structure of a protein is just the amino acid sequence. Remember, they're just like letters that make up a word. And here's amino acid number 3, and it could be any one of, what, 20 different kinds of amino acids. And then here is amino acid number 2 right here. And in order for this protein to have the right function, it's got to have the right structure, so the correct amino acid has to be put in this location, right? And the same for amino acid number 3 right here. So the primary structure is just the correct sequence of letters that make up a word, or the correct sequence of amino acids that make up a protein. Okay. Furthermore, if the word is spelled properly, look what happens to this, or one of the possibilities that can happen to this particular protein. These are all amino acids. And what can you tell me about the structure that you see right here? Is it just random, or is there something kind of nifty about it? Yeah, there's something kind of nifty. It formed that coil, right? That's a high degree of structure. And we call that the alpha helix. All right? Alpha helix is determined by the primary structure, but alpha helix is what we call secondary structure. All right, so there are hydrogen bonds between different amino acids in this sequence of amino acids that make it coil up just in this particular way. We call that an alpha helix. All right, that's due to hydrogen bonds. Another kind of structure is what we call a beta pleated sheet. Ooh, I don't know if I have a picture of it. I don't have a picture of it. But an alpha helix, like we see, is a nice coil like this. A beta pleated sheet is more like an accordion shape kind of structure, where it's a bit more jagged like that. But nonetheless, it's a highly ordered protein chain. And again, there's going to be hydrogen bonds between various amino acids. And if we switch out this amino acid right here, we will destroy that hydrogen bond. Guess what's going to happen to this beta pleated sheet? It's going to change. Maybe there's going to be a big long segment right there, and it won't fit into the overall protein like it should. All right, so don't forget, whenever you change the structure, you're going to change the function. All right, so here we have the alpha helix. What's the building block for alpha helix? Okay, what's the building block of life? Does anybody know from anatomy what the building block of life is? I want to use building blocks a lot in this class. Well, I haven't talked about cells yet. But a building block of life is a cell. Okay, that's the next chapter, sorry. But let me think of another example that we talked about. What's a building block of a polysaccharide? Monosaccharide. Okay, and we kind of alluded to this one. What's the building block of a membrane or plasma membrane? Is going to be that phospholipid molecule. So I'm going to refer to building blocks all the time, like the building block of a protein, amino acid. And in particular, we're going to see different layers of structure in a protein. We're talking secondary structure right now, and I want you to be able to know, what is the building block of secondary structure of a protein? What comes before that? Primary structure. And primary structure is what? The sequence of amino acid. And that's really what determines whether a segment of a protein can go into an alpha helix. So I would say that the building block of secondary structure is primary structure, right? How do you spell out the word, that protein, right? Just the sequence of amino acids, okay? And secondary structure can either be this alpha helix or that beta pleated sheet. I wish I had my book. I wonder if we have a picture of a beta pleated sheet in your... There's one in your book? Okay, I don't have a slide of it here. All right, but there's another structure that develops. When there are regions of alpha helix or beta pleated sheet, a protein can be an extremely long molecule. Maybe you could think of it as a thread that you have between your hands as you spread your hands out. And if you want to put that thread in your pocket, what do you got to do? Because your pocket isn't that long, you got to kind of fold it up somehow, squish it up, and put it in your pocket, right? And so proteins get folded up all the time as well. And if the primary structure is proper, an alpha helical region will form, right? That's a high degree. But other parts of the protein are just going to be bent in different ways depending on the position of the alpha helix or a beta pleated sheet, right? So the tertiary structure of a protein is really the three-dimensional shape of a protein, how it curves and folds on itself. And you might think that it's kind of random, but it's actually very particular. And proteins will take the proper tertiary shape only when it's being made, right? And just when you write out a word, how do you write a word out? Like, you write the whole word on a piece of paper at one time, or what do you do?
Letter by letter.
Yeah, letter by letter. And do you start at the back? Yeah, usually not in English. You start at the front of the word and write the word out. Okay, so think of your body making proteins that way. It starts with the first amino acid and the second. And if it's built that way, as it comes out, the protein starts to curl and form, and it attains the structure that you see right here. Right, so a protein can take all different kinds of structures, but it'll only take this proper one, all right, as it's being made. And so we call this the native conformation, or the native form of this protein right here. All right. And this form, in some places, is pretty stable, and in other places is not very stable. For instance, if there are sulfhydryl groups that form a disulfide bridge right here, that will be a very strong structure in the molecule that can't be changed. This alpha helix is pretty strong, but what really determines this alpha helix right here? What kind of bonds? Basically hydrogen bonds, and they're what? Relatively strong or weak? They're relatively weak. So, right, the overall shape or tertiary structure of this protein is not super strong. It can be altered. It can be manipulated. Right? And as a matter of fact, we manipulate these proteins all the time. And once we change the shape of a protein, it is impossible to get it back to where it was. It's catastrophic. Okay. So we call that process denaturation, and that can be done with temperature and pH. And another way of thinking of denaturation is just cooking. Do you ever cook any food? Sometimes. Okay. Well, let's think of a hamburger, for instance. All right. A lot of people eat raw hamburger. Okay, but I usually don't. Okay, I usually cook it. And so you know what raw hamburger kind of looks like. Yeah, it's really, you know, it's very malleable, it falls apart, right? And so when you cook it, what does a hamburger turn into?
Brown.
It's brown, it's a lot more solid, but it's a lot easier to eat, it's a lot easier to chew up. All right, so, but it is an irreversible kind of process. Say I went home and I cooked a hamburger tonight, and just as I was going to sit down and eat that hamburger, I get a phone call from one of you guys, and you say, you know, a pool table just opened up, but we need a fourth person. You got to come down and shoot some pool with me, right? And so what am I going to say? Oh, I just cooked this hamburger, and I'm going to eat it, and I'm not going to come shoot pool? You know, that won't ever work. So you take the hamburger that's cooked, and what do you do? Well, you could take, well, that's a good suggestion, but you might put it, all right, so you had some raw hamburger, you cooked it up, you got it up to a really high temperature, it got denatured, all those proteins changed their structure away from the native conformation into a different structure altogether. Those hydrogen bonds were broken because they're weak. The van der Waals forces couldn't hold the protein together, all right, and So you go, I'm going to just put it in the refrigerator. I'll come back and eat it later. So you put it in the refrigerator, and it went from a high temperature where it got denatured back down to refrigerator temperature. Does it go back to looking like a raw hamburger? No, right? So denaturation is what? Irreversible. You can't go back to the way it was. And the only example that I can think of where denaturation or denaturing a protein that is reversible is when you get your hair permed. Okay, because if you put curls in your hair, maybe in 2 weeks you don't like curls anymore, you can get them taken out and you can get straight hair again. Right? But that's, if anybody else knows of another example of denaturing a protein, changing its native configuration and then going back to the native configuration, that's a really difficult process to do. All right, so heat and temperature, changes in salt concentration can denature a protein. Because as you change the salt concentration, you change the nature of all kinds of hydrophilic associations within the molecule. And you change hydrogen bonding within the molecule. All right, so we usually cook food by heating. But you can cook food by changing the pH. Who knows a food that you cook by changing the pH of it? By putting it in an acid or maybe a base, but it's usually acid. Oh, shrimps you can cook by putting in, like lemon juice, because lemon juice is very acidic, or lime, yeah. So ceviche is how you can cook fish, for instance, or seafood. All right, sauerbraten is a way that you can actually, that's a German kind of food, that you can take a brisket, a big beef steak or something, and put it in vinegar, and that vinegar then will denature all of those proteins, make it edible. Okay, and when you denature a protein, you'll also preserve it, right? So denaturation, whether it's cooking with temperature or pH, preserves it as well. And salt concentration, do you ever cook anything by changing the salt concentration? Okay, yeah, that's a way to preserve food. You can cook and denature proteins with high salt concentration as well. Okay, all right, so those are the three main ways. Yeah. Oh, yeah, let's get this sign-in sheet going around right away. All right, don't forget, those of you that added the class, please show me your transcript, and I'll get that prerequisite clicked off. So don't forget, you do need those prerequisites for this class, yeah.
Okay, so of course, denatured, it's in a native conformation.
Okay, a denatured protein is not in a native conformation.
Before it's denatured,
it's in a native conformation, okay. Yeah. Conformation just means shape. And... okay, when you denature a protein, you change its shape, you change what?
Function.
You're going to change its function. So certain enzymes that produce certain kinds of chemical reactions, once they're denatured, are not going to be able to produce those chemical reactions anymore, and that's really what preserves food for us, because you kill all the enzymatic activity in those proteins in that particular sample. All right, so here we have the three-dimensional shape of a protein. We call that the tertiary structure. What's the building block of tertiary structure?
Secondary
structure. And what's the building block of secondary structure?
Primary
structure, right? So, and you can kind of follow that thinking along. So primary structure eventually is going to determine the tertiary structure of a protein. All right, and a protein might have little pockets in it where it can bind a special another kind of organic compound, like a heme group that might have, say, an iron molecule right here, which is going to have an affinity for oxygen. So now this protein chain right here, because of the way it's been folded up, can actually carry oxygen around in our bodies. Right? And does anybody know what the compound is that carries oxygen in our bodies?
Hemoglobin.
It's hemoglobin. Yeah, hemoglobin. So this might be an example of hemoglobin, but actually... right? In order for hemoglobin to work, it's not just one protein chain. There are four that come together. Ooh, do I have a picture? Oh, yeah, here. Okay. So here is really hemoglobin. You can see four different proteins that come together, and they all have their own heme group, and they come together. Why do they fit together like that? Because they have the proper shape. They have the proper amino acids with hydrogen bonds between them in just the right location, right? And so some proteins actually have different, what we call subunits. And if different subunits come together to form this protein right there, we call that the quaternary structure of a protein. All right, and these different protein chains can actually be bound together with covalent bonds. So it can actually become a fairly strong molecule. Okay. Not all proteins have quaternary structure, but hemoglobin is such a good example. We use that all the time. All right, so this big group of four proteins can only come together if they have what? The proper shape, right? Like hand in glove kind of shape. They got to have the proper shape to fit together. And so quaternary structure is dependent on the proper tertiary structure, and the proper tertiary structure is dependent on the proper secondary, and the secondary structure is determined by the primary structure. So think of each one of those as being building blocks, right? So a good question would be, what's the building block of quaternary structure of a protein? It's the tertiary structure. It's got to have the right shape in order for it to fit together, like a puzzle, right, that you're putting together on the table. Okay, we got some questions. Yeah. That still would be quaternary structure, yeah. Or if there's three subunits that come together, we would still call that quaternary structure. It's quaternary because we go primary, secondary, tertiary, and then this is at the last level, okay? Not because it has the four subunits. Does it have to be four proteins? Could be two, could be three. I don't have examples on the tip of my tongue, though. Yeah, way in the back. If it is a covalent bond, that's a possibility. Okay. If it's disulfide bridge that's being formed, yes. But if it's just hydrogen bonds, it's not a dehydration synthesis. Or if it's just the association of hydrophobic groups, okay, that's not a dehydration synthesis. It's just like molecules with the same domains, like hydrophobic domains, can associate with each other because they're comfortable being next to each other. All right, so there's different levels of strength. Okay. And I think the next slide kind of shows that. Oh, no. Previous slide shows that. So here we have, it almost looks like an alpha helix, right, all the way through this region. Here we have an amino acid with an amino group. Here we have an amino acid with a carboxyl group. These ionize, so that can form a nice ionic bond between these two regions of this protein chain. And so an ionic bond is fairly stable, right? Unless you do what? Unless you change the pH drastically or the salt concentration is going to change the strength of this bond right here, and it might change the shape of this bend. All right, so this represents the tertiary structure, the overall structure of a protein. That's one kind of bond. What else? We can have strong covalent bonds. Right, so it's very difficult to take this bend out of this protein because this is a very strong covalent bond. Here is a hydrogen bond between two amino acids. This is relatively weak. So by changing the temperature, this is one that can be interrupted or broken very, very easily to denature this protein. And of course, the weakest one is just the association between different hydrophobic substitutions on amino acids over here forming these van der Waals forces, right? So possibly if we were to take this protein and put it in a test tube and shake it up, you could probably even break these van der Waals forces, okay, and maybe denature a protein that way. That would be a good experiment to do in lab, okay? But for sure, these would not be heat stable, okay? And those would change very early on as the pH started to change. Okay, proteins can be pure. They can be made out of just amino acids, but they can be modified as well, right? Changing their structure, which means it's going to change their function. There can be things that start off as a protein, and they can be modified or conjugated or joined to a sugar molecule. So now we have a sugar protein, and we call those glycoproteins. Glyco is, of course, like sugar. Protein is protein. So they contain carbohydrates. There's a special organelle inside the cell that can modify a protein. I don't know if you can remember that from anatomy or not, but we talked about it in anatomy. There's a special organelle whose job is to take proteins from rough endoplasmic reticulum and modify them and package them up into vesicles. And that is a Golgi apparatus. What's another name for Golgi apparatus? Golgi body, right? And so, what's your favorite glycoprotein? Like mucus. Okay, mucus or mucopolysaccharide. Muco means protein, saccharide means sugar. All right, that's the thing that comes running out of your nose when you have a cold. Okay, mucus. There can be lipoproteins. They contain what? Lipids, and part lipid, part protein as well. Okay, that might, for instance, stabilize a protein that needs to be inserted into the plasma membrane. Because what is a plasma membrane made out of? Yeah, lipids, right? Proteins don't necessarily like to dissolve in lipids, but if they're conjugated with a lipid, now part of it is going to want to stick in the plasma membrane, and that protein can perform its function while anchored very nicely within the plasma membrane. Okay, and other kinds of proteins like hemoglobin we just looked at have pigments in them. And that iron group can absorb light. That's not why it's in there, because it absorbs light. It really has an affinity for oxygen, but because of the configuration of that iron atom in hemoglobin, what color does it give blood? Does it give blood any kind of color? Yeah, really bright red when it's oxygenated, right? So any kind of compound that absorbs light and it has, gives you then a color that you can see with your eye, we call that a pigment. All right, so these yellow chairs, are they yellow? Yeah, good. The chairs are yellow. Oops, what did I do? Not too much. Good. All right, so that yellow incorporated into the chairs is what? A pigment, because it absorbs certain wavelengths of light. Okay. All right, so here is just a table that shows some selected proteins in the body. All right, the number of polypeptide chains that make it up. So here's insulin. It has two. But it, since it has two, that's still quaternary structure. That's still the quaternary structure. Okay. All right, that takes us to our fourth biological compound, nucleic acids. And they have some important properties. They hold information in our body. They can be used for energy. All right, so let's look at a couple of its main functions in terms of it making DNA and RNA. So the basic building block of DNA and RNA is this guy right here. Oops, this guy right here. And so what's the building block of protein? Amino acid. What's the building block of DNA? It's a nucleotide. Okay, so a nucleotide, let me get my arrow back. All right, so here's a nucleotide. It's got a sugar molecule, and this is not like glucose. Glucose has 6 carbons, this one has 5 carbons, but nonetheless, it's a pretty long hydrocarbon chain. And what do big, long molecules have a tendency to do, or anything that's big and long? Yeah, it can form cyclic structures. So here's a nice cyclic structure. It folds back on itself. And in this one position right here, it's modified by a phosphate group. All right, and that's a pretty reactive group. And then on this other end of the molecule, there's a basic group. And I don't think I'm going to ask you to memorize. Well, I'm going to ask you a little bit about the shape of this molecule right here. Okay, but this is the general form of both DNA and RNA nucleotides. Right? And each nucleotide can be joined with another one via this position on the carbon ring and the phosphate group. And guess what reaction is used to put different nucleotides together? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, that's how important that is. And, of course, DNA and RNA can be broken down into nucleotides by what kind of reaction? Hydrolysis reactions, by putting water back in there. Okay. The 4 bases that make up DNA are guanine, thymine, cytosine, and adenine. And you can see that guanine is kind of big, and adenine is kind of big, and thymine and cytosine are kind of small bases. All right, so that's going to have an important meaning for how DNA can be put together. Okay, for DNA, the 5-carbon sugar right here is called deoxyribose. And so, right, that's how we get this acronym DNA. That stands for deoxyribose. What can you tell me if I say deoxy? Does that have any connotation to you at all? Deoxy means, D means to subtract from or remove. So we have a nucleotide with oxygen removed from one position. Maybe I have that on, where do I have that? Ah, right here. Let's look at this one. All right, so here we have ribose, right? But we have an oxygen that's missing at this position right here. So we call this deoxyribose. If we substitute an OH group instead of this hydrogen, as in this condition over here, this is what we call a ribose molecule. So we got ribose and deoxyribose, and these two can be used to make nucleotides. This one here would make nucleotides that go into DNA, and these right here would make nucleotides that go into RNA, right? And so this little substitution right here changes kind of in a radical way what the function of these molecules are. Okay, I'm going to come back to this slide in a little bit. All right, so with a dehydration synthesis reaction, we can put nucleotides together and make a big long string of nucleotides. And there's something else. DNA can form a structure. I got to go backwards just a little bit. All right, so here's one strand of DNA. DNA always exists in a double-stranded configuration. Double-stranded configuration made up of two different strands. Because of missing that oxygen group on that one position in the deoxyribose molecule, it forms, right, this what we call an alpha helix, right, a double helix. It allows the molecule to twist and turn. And the other thing that stabilizes the alpha helix is that there is base pairing between the opposite strands. Remember, we said that one of the bases is large and there are other bases that are small, right? So in order to make this base pairing between opposite strands in a DNA molecule, a large base has to pair up with a small base. And it just so happens that cytosine and guanine are able to form 3 hydrogen bonds between them, but adenine and thymine can only form 2. Right, so adenine can't base pair with guanine, adenine can't base pair with cytosine because it doesn't have the right number of hydrogen bonds between it. And so what we see right here are a couple things. The base pairing rules in DNA. Cytosine always has to base pair with guanine, and thymine always has to base pair with adenine because of the size and the shape determines the number of hydrogen bonds that can form. All right, the overall structure of DNA, maybe you could think of it as a ladder, right? And the handrails that you would hold on to as you climb up the ladder are made out of 2 compounds. What's this one here? Phosphate. And this one is?
5-carbon sugar.
Yeah, that's that 5-carbon sugar, which in DNA is called deoxyribose, right? And then we got what? Phosphate, deoxyribose. Phosphate, deoxyribose, and then what's here? Phosphate, deoxyribose, and that goes on and on and on. So that's what makes the handrails. The phosphate sugar groups make up the handrails. Now what about the steps of the ladder? What makes the steps of the ladder up? The bases, yeah. And they have to follow this base pairing rule, and when they do, look what happens to the shape of this molecule. It forms this really cool 3-dimensional shape that we call the double helix. Okay. But now, what is holding together these 2 different strands of the DNA molecule? Is it a strong chemical bond or weak chemical bond? It's a weak chemical bond. And so your cells know how to zip this molecule together, but also it knows how to unzip it. And it's easy to do because they're what? Hydrogen bonds. So all day long, it's being zipped and unzipped because what we have right here, right, we have a sequence of nucleotides. So this is acting like a dictionary on how to spell a word. And what's the word that we're thinking of? The words are proteins, right? In order to build a specific protein, you got to know what sequence of amino acids have to be put together to to spell that word. And the dictionary that knows how to spell words is your DNA, because it has a certain primary structure that's determined by a different sequence of nucleotides in the DNA molecule. All right, now, another thing that you should know about DNA is, where do you find it? DNA makes up chromosomes. Where do you find chromosomes? In the cell nucleus, right? So it's within the nucleus. So that's something else that can distinguish DNA from RNA, and that is location. You should never find DNA out in the cytoplasm anywhere except when the cell is dividing. What do we call it when a cell divides? It's going to be mitosis, right? And maybe we'll learn something about meiosis a little bit later. Okay, so besides DNA, there are molecules called RNA. RNA is different because there's an oxygen at this position right here, but there is a substitution for the bases as well. In RNA, you never find thymine. Wherever there was a thymine in DNA, it's going to be switched over to uracil. All right, so that is really the big difference. And because this oxygen is put in ribose, or to make this a ribose, right, RNA cannot form that staircase that winds around that we call a double helix. So the structure of RNA is what? More globular. It doesn't have the same tertiary structure because there's no room for it to twist around on itself because of this little extra oxygen molecule right there. Okay. There are three kinds of RNA. And let me see what the next... Oh, that's the end of this one? Okay, we're going to talk about what these are used for a little bit later in the class. All right, but the three major kinds of RNA that's in our cell, there is messenger RNA. These are long strands of RNA, which are complementary copies of the sequence of nucleotides in DNA. All right, so it's going to match up to the sequence of nucleotides in DNA, and so it's going to be like a copy of your DNA. The only difference is DNA cannot leave the nucleus, but that RNA can, and then it can be used to make proteins within the cytoplasm without taking the DNA out of the nucleus. Right, and that's really important, because if you take DNA out of the nucleus, it can be destroyed. Right, there can be a nick put in it, and then the dictionary gets lost, and you can't build that protein ever again. What's going to happen to a cell that can no longer make proteins? It's going to die. It's going to have a very short life. Right, so that information in DNA has to be protected. But it needs to go out into the cytoplasm. It goes out into the cytoplasm as RNA, and in particular, messenger RNA. All right, so messenger RNA is going to be used to make proteins, because that's the dictionary on how to build a protein from amino acids. Inside the cell, in the cytoplasm, there has to be a workbench to make proteins. And there's a RNA that makes the workbench for making proteins, and that's called ribosomal RNA that makes the workbench. So guess what the function of a ribosome is? It's to make a protein. It's the workbench where proteins are made. All right. So a ribosome needs a messenger RNA, which is like the dictionary on how to spell a particular protein. All right. But it also needs something else. What else does a ribosome need besides information on how to make a protein, or how to spell it out correctly? What's the building block of a protein? Amino acids, right? So a ribosome needs amino acids to make a protein, and there's a special kind of amino acid that carries, there's a special kind of RNA that carries amino acids to a ribosome so that proteins can be made. These wander around the cell, grab an amino acid, bring it over to a ribosome so that a protein can be made. And so I call that a taxi RNA, but you shouldn't really call it that. It's called a transfer RNA. So transfer RNA just brings amino acids to a ribosome so that a protein can be made. All right, so let me see what I have. That's it for this particular chapter. But let me see if I have a little fun exercise to do right here. All right, so I do want you to know something about structure of different chemicals. All right, so we're going to go over some structures right now. All right, some chemical structures. And so this right here is just a little rest station. So if you don't see anything right there, that's okay. Right? You're not supposed to be able to recognize that. That's just a rectangle. All right, but this one here, you should be able to recognize this one. And we're going to look over these figures a number of times. What do we got? Here is a phosphate group. Here is a 5-carbon, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5-carbon sugar. Okay, and that's either a ribose or a deoxyribose. But here is that oxygen, so is that a deoxyribose or a ribose? That's a ribose. So phosphate group, ribose, and then here is a base. You don't have to know which one that is. But what you should know is what kind of compound do you get when you put a base, a ribose, and a phosphate together just in this conformation. It's a building block for RNA, okay? And in particular, what's a building block of RNA? It's a nucleotide. And let's be just a little bit more specific. It could be a ribonucleotide or a deoxyribonucleotide. This one right here that you see is a ribonucleotide. Why would you say that's a ribonucleotide? Because it's got the oxygen right there. All right? So I want you to develop a little feel for what these molecules are by their shape. Okay. Tell me what that group is right there. Yeah, you should know. That's a sulfhydryl group, right? On this long hydrocarbon chain. And that's a nice, what, polar group on this hydrocarbon chain. Sulfhydryl group. Here is another functional group. That's an amino group. What kind of compound has an amino group on it that we just talked about? It's a building block for a protein. Amino acid. All right, so I want you to start making some of these connections up. And that's a pretty reactive group because it can help dehydration synthesis reactions to form a peptide bond, right, this amino group right here. So it's not a trivial thing to know about. What about this right here? Carboxyl group. Again, it's an important group for synthesizing a triglyceride because it can undergo dehydration synthesis reaction as well as being an acidic group, right, carboxyl group. Phosphate group. What do we got right here? Long hydrocarbon chain, but we got a bunch of hydroxide groups on it. Okay, so this is a monosaccharide. That's what I want you to know. You don't have to know if it's galactose or glucose or whatever, but it's a monosaccharide, right? It's just a 6-carbon sugar, and of course, you know, it can form that cyclic structure. So in your book, you're going to see it mostly as this stop sign kind of figure, but is this soluble in water or not? Yeah, because here's a nice polar covalent bond, right? Because oxygen is very electronegative, just like the oxygen in water. That makes water a polar solvent. Ooh, what's this beast? A long hydrophobic region in a carboxyl group. So it's very, very nonpolar. All right, that's what we call a fatty acid. Here's a fatty acid. And why do we say acid? Because of this carboxyl group right here, which makes it really nice and reactive so that we can form triglycerides with it, with a dehydration synthesis reaction. And in particular, what kind of fatty acid? You don't have to know the name, but it's completely saturated, right? That's a saturated fatty acid. Tell me the reaction that's happening if we go in the forward direction. Dehydration synthesis. So what is this little guy here? That is a triglyceride. What are these three compounds? 3 fatty acid. And what is this one right here? That is a glycerol molecule, right? And if you chop a glucose in half, you can get a couple of these. Okay, so that's triglyceride synthesis via dehydration synthesis reaction. If you go back the other way, what kind of reaction would that be? Hydrolysis reaction. Okay. What's this? Monosaccharide. Okay. And what is this right here? Yeah, this is a micelle, and the building block of a micelle are these phospholipids. But what else you should know? Well, you got this all this hydrophobic region here on the inside, hydrophilic region on the outside. So these things can dissolve in water, and that actually is what? The precursor of membranes and cells. Because you have to have like nanotechnology to build these things. Do you have to have micro tweezers to build these things? Or do they just form automatically? They form automatically. Okay. What kind of compounds are these? Steroids. And steroids are what kind of compound? They're lipids. They're lipids. So they don't necessarily like to dissolve in water. They're a lot happier in oil than water. What's this? This is an unsaturated fatty acid. Yep, unsaturated fatty acid. Raise your hand if you don't see that. Unsaturated fatty acid. Okay, well, we're going to go over this a number of times. Okay, fatty acid, because it's a long hydrocarbon chain with this carboxyl group right here, which makes it an acid. So this part is fatty, it is hydrophobic, and the acid group makes it, well, an acid. The carboxyl group makes it an acid, so we call that a fatty acid. What can a fatty acid be used? It's a building block for something. Yeah, triglycerides. Okay, and it also has to participate to make a phospholipid, right? Because this part right here is going to make what on a phospholipid? These long hydrophobic tails that make up the part of the phospholipid. All right. Fortunately, we can go over this 100 times before the test, so that's okay. All right. What's this compound here? Amino group, carboxyl group. This is an amino acid, and in this position right here, various things can be substituted to maybe give it some hydrophilic nature or hydrophobic nature, which is going to then be able to relate to different parts of a protein to give that protein its proper tertiary shape, right, or tertiary structure. You would put these together to make a protein. By what kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay, let's see, what do we got right here? Phospholipid, here's that glycerol molecule with two fatty acids, but in the third position, we've got this substitution with a phosphate and nitrogen, so that makes this very hydrophilic. This region is very hydrophobic, so it's a pretty magical kind of molecule, right? Can dissolve in either kinds of compounds, water or oil, or right at the interface between the two. What's it a building block of? Membrane. Okay, we're going to get the membrane. This is the basic building block of a membrane. Okay, these right here. These are prostaglandins. What class of compounds do prostaglandins belong to? So what are your choices? Carbohydrates, proteins, lipids, or nucleic acids? These are lipids because we have the long hydrocarbon chain right here, and it's just been folded over in one position, right? So here's the carboxyl group, so maybe you can see fatty acid right there. All right, what is this thing right here? This is secondary structure, right? All of these are different amino acids that have been put together. What's the building block of secondary structure? Primary structure. All right, so here's secondary structure. Do I have a beta pleated sheet? No. All right, what do we got right here? We got a base. Yeah, we got a base, phosphate, and some kind of ribose. It's a 5-carbon sugar, but the oxygen's missing, so this is a nucleotide. But what kind of nucleotide? Deoxyribonucleotide. So this would be used to make DNA in particular. It's going to allow that long sequence to bend and swirl in a certain way to make the double helix. What's a good movie to understand something about the double helix that you should rent this weekend? Jurassic Park. Because they talk about all this stuff even in Jurassic Park. Okay. All right, next molecule. Functional group. Hydroxyl group. Right, OH, hydroxyl group. And name this molecule here. I see 1, 2, 3 carbons. This is glycerol. Glycerol, it's a building block for triglycerides. You can put a fatty acid here and a fatty acid here and a fatty acid here, right, via a dehydration synthesis reaction to make a triglyceride. But you can also put that fancy phosphate group here, in which case you would get what? You would, if you have two fatty acids here and here and that super phosphate group, that would make a phospholipid. All right, so this is a building block of a phospholipid as well as a triglyceride. All right, what's here? Yeah, here's that glycerol. Here are two fatty acids. And then here is the polar head group on the phospholipid that makes a phospholipid. What kind of group is this? That's a carbonyl group. Carbonyl. Okay, tell me what this is. This is a ribonucleotide, right? So it's a nucleotide. You know it's ribose because it has the oxygen right here. What would be the other one? Deoxyribonucleotide. Okay. All right, so let's see how we can do right here. What is that thing? Sulfhydryl group. What's that one? Amino group. What's that? Carboxyl group. Oh, I missed a click. Okay, carboxyl group. What's that? Phosphate group. And what's that? Monosaccharide. Ready for the next one? Saturated fatty acid. Right? And could you see the carboxyl group on the end? All right. Yeah, triglyceride formation. You could say what? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Okay. How about that? Another monosaccharide? Go ahead, say it before I say it. What's that? It's a micelle. What's the building block of a micelle? Phospholipid. Okay. Those are steroids. What class of compounds do steroids fit into? Lipids, right. So those are lipids, but steroids in particular, I wanted you to see with that. What's that? Unsaturated fatty acid. Another one. Amino acid. All right. You know what? I'll keep it on the screen until we say agree on to what it is. But say it as fast as you can. So really try to recognize it. What's that? Phospholipid, right? So there's a fatty acid. There's a phosphate group. Hydrophobic tails. All right. What's this here? These are all prostaglandins that are derived from fatty acids. What do we got here? Secondary structure. That's the alpha helix of a protein. What's the building block of that?
Primary structure.
Looks like a nucleotide to me. What kind? It's missing an oxygen. So it is a deoxyribonucleotide. Yeah. You know what? Since I'm colorblind, I can't even tell you which color is which. I didn't tell this class because I didn't want you all to drop the class. All right, so since I can't tell where purple is right there, where the arrow is? Yeah, where the H is. What's your question? It's a good question. Oh, yeah. If there's an oxygen there, that is a ribose, that goes into making RNA. If the oxygen is missing, it's a deoxyribose, and that goes into making DNA. So it's going to change the shape of the molecule, how it folds in on itself, and whether it can actually form a double-stranded molecule or a single-stranded molecule. So yeah, it does. Okay, so I do want you to know what's a deoxyribonucleotide or a ribonucleotide by looking at that oxygen right there. The other thing is, on your test, what kind of tests are you going to get? Living color or grayscale? It's going to be grayscale. Yeah, I'd have to charge everybody $10 to take a test, right? And for sure I wouldn't have $10 times how many students are in here. So your tests are not going to be in color, right? So understand the structure and the relation, just like in anatomy. If you were given figures in anatomy, you know structures by their shape and relationship to other structures as well, not by artificial coloring. All right. Yeah, I've got a video for you to watch even. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so I have a video where you can practice this. So we're going to go, and I want to still go over this because we got 10 minutes left in class. So I want to go over it again, maybe not quite so fast. Go ahead. Yeah, you have a question? Yeah, on Blackboard. I'll have to go and look, and maybe I'll pull it up and you can see where it is, right? All right, so let's continue a little bit. And maybe as we start class next time, we'll start with this too. So this is really important. Guess where you can see these structures? Yeah, but even more importantly, on the test. Okay? So yeah, on the test. So this could be on the test. And for this structure, you would say what? Deoxyribonucleotide. All right? But you should also be familiar, that's used as a building block for making DNA. And because it's missing that molecule there, that DNA molecule can form that nice tight little package. Okay, the double strand. All right, so you ready for another one. What do we got? Hydroxyl group. All right, next one. So I'm going to go through this two more times. Yeah, so be quiet. We're going to go through slow, and then we're going to speed it up just a little bit. Okay? All right, so we got glycerol. You got three carbons right there, glycerol. And then we got phospholipid. And then we have carbonyl group. And then we've got ribonucleotide. And then we got sulfhydryl group. This gives proteins. It helps aid in this tertiary structure because it can form disulfide bridges. Amino group. A carboxyl group. Oh, I missed the click. Phosphate group. Just a nice monosaccharide. And you should know why that dissolves in water. And then we have a saturated fatty acid. And we have triglyceride synthesis. And you can see the building blocks for a triglyceride right there if you want to. Here we got another monosaccharide. And we've got a micelle. Basic building block of a micelle is that phospholipid. Steroids. Which are lipids. And here's another kind of lipid. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino acid. Phospholipid. These are prostaglandins. You take a fatty acid, fold it up. Fatty acid. Important signaling molecule. Secondary structure of a protein. Deoxyribonucleotide. Okay, what does a phosphate in this deoxyribose, what does it make up? The handrails. The handrails of the double helix. What makes the steps? This base that's sticking out into the interior of the double helix. All right, next one. Hydroxyl group. Glycerol. Phospholipid. The carbonyl group. Ribonucleotide. All right, so I think we've gone through it all a little bit. So we're not going to go through it super fast, but I'm just really pay attention to the board and see if we can just burn an impression in your mind what this molecule is. Okay? So I'm just going to flash it on the screen quickly. Sulfhydryl group. Amino group. Carboxyl group. Phosphate group. Monosaccharide. Saturated fatty acid. Triglyceride synthesis. Monosaccharide. Micelle. Steroids. Unsaturated fatty acid. Amino acid. Phospholipid. Prostaglandin. Secondary structure.
Deoxyribonucleotide.
Hydroxyl group. Glycerol. Phospholipid. Carbonyl group. Ribonucleotide. Sulfhydryl group. Amino group. Carboxyl group. All right, that's pretty good for right now. All right, so I want everybody to sign the sign-in sheet. All right, we're going to do that a bunch of times. You'll probably be fatigued. If you want to see where it is in Blackboard, I'll mouse around in Blackboard and see if I can find the video for you, but I think it's there. It's there. You saw that already? Okay, it should be there. Okay, one hint. If you want to view that video, Real Player should work. Windows Media Player should work, but if your updates are not current, they might not play the audio track, or it might play the audio and not the video. So I would just, instead of updating, I download that DivX player, the DIVX player. It's always worked every time. All right? I'm sure it does, but don't click on the PC version. It might automatically know which version to make. All right, who's got the sign-in sheet? Sign-in sheet? Sign-in sheet. Who's got the sign-in sheet?